Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
This seemed like a joke when it first came out. It seemed like even more of a joke. It seemed like an internet hoax or some moron pretending to be an NBA insider with a fake internet account, dropping some bomb, looking to see how many people that he could hook with that bomb. I'm talking about the James Harden to Brooklyn Nets angle. I'm talking about James Harden playing with Kevin Durant. I'm talking about James Harden playing with Kyrie Irving. I'm talking about James Harden playing with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. So when that came up, it sounded like the dumbest thing ever. It sounded like your typical internet bullcrap clickbait manufactured by some D-bag looking to get likes on their feed. And when they aren't posting made-up trade reports, they're putting up old highlights with the captions like, Tom Chambers was a problem. And then dopes get into arguments in the comments section about whether or not Tom Chambers would succeed in the modern NBA. And by the way, Chambers was a problem. And he absolutely would have a place in today's game. But I digress. So, when James Harden to the Nets first surfaced, I ignored it because I knew it was just some idiot jerking everybody's chain. Don't get me wrong. I would love for it to be a real thing. Because what would be better? Nothing. But as always, if something seems too good to be true, it's because it generally is. Except this isn't. This actually is a real thing. And while anything but a lock, this could actually happen. Now, I don't want to make this about me, because that's never been my deal. You know that about me. The one thing you know about me is that I would never make it about me. But why don't we go ahead and make this about me? I don't ask for very much. In fact, I don't ask for anything. The only thing I've ever asked for is that you have a take and you not suck. And that you do not bring personal appearance smack to the program. Or bum smack. Or fat smack. Other than that, I never ask anybody for anything. I'm good. I really don't want anything. Except for James Harden to run alongside KD and Kyrie. I admit it. I want that. I want that. In fact, I want that more than I think I've ever wanted anything in my life. Anything in the world. Now you might say, hey now, hold up, Rome. Hold up. Didn't you want and weren't you obsessed with seeing an NFL team run the table backwards? I mean, sure, I guess, sort of, maybe, but not like I want this. I've never wanted anything in or out of sports as much as I want James Harden running with KD and Kyrie, because that would be amazing. And the amazing things, or it would be amazing in an only 2020. Only in 2020, sort of way. That kind of amazing. It'd be unbelievable. So there was the report from ESPN that Harden turned down a 2-year extension that would have kept him in Houston until 2025. It would have paid him $103 million for 2 years. That would have made him the first $50 million a year player in the NBA. So on the one hand, if you're turning down $103 million right now, it seems like you really want out. On the other hand, Harden has to know that that's not a one-time offer only. The money's still going to be there if he decides that he wants to stay. And again, it's not just Harden who wants out, reportedly. Russell Westbrook also wants out, which yet again raises the question, the hell happened to the Rockets? I mean, it was not that long ago that the only thing that stood between the Rockets and an NBA championship was Chris Paul's hamstring, because they had a transcendent Warriors team on the ropes as recently as 2018. That's not that long ago. And now they're ripping apart. And now they're in a really tough spot with not one, but two Hall of Famers who want out. Their head coach is already gone. Their GM is already gone. And by the way, if you're Harden and you recognize that you're 31 and you're on a team that is not built to compete for an NBA title, why wouldn't you be looking around? Why wouldn't you want to see what's out there? And that's before we get into any personal issues that might exist in that organization. According to ESPN, the Rockets know they're in an awkward spot, but The Rockets are, quote, willing to get uncomfortable, unquote, for a while. So in other words, they will not be pressured into dealing Westbrook or Harden. Just because Harden and Westbrook both want out does not mean they have to accommodate that request. They're under contract. They don't have to do jack. That's cool. I get that. Business is business. But how about this? How about this? How about you just trade James Harden to the Nets? How about you get comfortable with that? If you really want to be uncomfortable, if you're really locked into being uncomfortable, that's fine too. Let me give you something that'll make you uncomfortable. You sending Harden to the Nets, if you do that, you will not in any way get fair value for this guy once you make that deal. That is an unwinnable trade for the Rockets. No way they make that deal and not get worked. If Drew Holiday to the Bucks was worth two players and three first-round picks and two pick swaps, what the hell does James Harden get you? Five players and a billion first-round picks? You get completely worked. However, it's not about you. It's not about Harden. It's about me. It's about the rest of us. You make that trade. And you lose that trade. And you do so knowing it's an enormous win for the rest of us. And James Harden playing with Kevin Durant makes sense, right? They're friends. They play together in OKC. And according to reports, Harden thinks very highly of Durant. That's a fact. Now let me give you one more fact. Kyrie Irving thinks very highly of Kyrie Irving. And that's why this is awesome. And incredible and legendary. Hell, this might be the best thing ever. A four-time scoring champ and a three-time scoring champ teaming up would be legendary. But the best part is, what would the guy with zero scoring titles think? He'd think he's the alpha. He'd think that he's option number one. He'd think that he's the only reason the other two even want to be together so they can play with him. That the reason things didn't work out with LeBron and Kyrie is because Kyrie was so much better than Braun, and Braun knew it, and Braun couldn't live with it. You know Kyrie's thinking all these things. Like, the only cliche there is in basketball that's better than this, well, there isn't one. This is it. That there's only one ball. That has never been more true than it would be on a team with Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Kyrie Irving. There's only one ball. If Kyrie did not like being Robin to LeBron's Batman, how is he going to like being Alfred the Butler to KD and Harden? Let me answer that for you. Horribly. If Durant did not like Draymond Green jawing with him in Golden State, how is he going to like it when Irving starts that in Brooklyn? Like, don't get me wrong. The basketball experience on the floor would be amazing at times. But when it goes wrong, and it always does with Kyrie, it would be even more incredible. And don't tell me that KD and Kyrie are professionals and they would just shut out the noise. Hell no. That's not how they're wired. Not only does KD not shut out the noise, he welcomes it. My man has got rabbit ears. As Ethan Strauss pointed out in the past, some stars in the league get angry with a reporter over a headline, but never actually read the article. Quote, not KD. He reads everything. He takes issue with specific sentences and phrases. A few in particular had inspired his ire, or so I heard. End quote. Like, this is a guy who spent a good chunk of his time in Golden State believing that the local media had it in for him because they loved Steph Curry more than they loved him. This is the same guy who was allegedly pissed that Maurice Spates was more popular and accepted by Warrior fans than he was. The guy who was allegedly bothered that Spates had the nickname Mo Buckets. Like, that's the kind of crap that KD lets infect his dome and get under his skin. So if he's getting worked up about Mo Buckets as a nickname, how the hell is it going to go when Kyrie does what Kyrie does and starts complaining to the media or starts trying to be the general manager of the team? Or gets his own nickname, or the fans like some random dude at the end of the bench more than they like KD. KD was like the prickliest guy in the Western Conference, and then he joined up with Kyrie, the prickliest guy in the Eastern Conference. And then you throw in the guy who does the mysterious fake nosebleed celebration after he dunks. Hell yes, I want that. I want all of that. And about 20 games in, when there's a two-game losing streak, and Kyrie has just gone 6-for-21 from the field, the post-game media sessions are going to be must-see TV. And the sub-tweeting will be even better. So give me the guy who was bent about Mo Buckets. Give me the guy who thinks that the earth is flat. Or that he was really clever when he said that the earth is flat. And give me the guy who once said this about Giannis.
But I wish I could just run and with 7 feet and run and just dunk. Like, that takes no skill at all. I got to actually learn how to play basketball and how to have skill, you know? I take that any day.
James Harden saying that Giannis is just 7 feet tall and dunks will never not be funny to me. And saying that, quote, it takes no skill at all, and quote, I got to actually learn how to play basketball to have skill is the best. Harden might be an all-time great NBA scorer of the ball, but that was an all-time horrible speaker of the take. Like an all-time horrible NBA take, and it cracks me up every single time I hear it. And now we have the chance. I just spent nearly 15 minutes laying this out. A dream. A chance of getting that guy on the same squad as KD and Kyrie. I don't just want this big three in Brooklyn. I need it. We all need it. And more than needing it, we deserve it. Give it to us, Houston. You owe it to us. You want to be uncomfortable? Great. Make that trade. Get worked in that trade. Give the people what they want. An all-time train wreck. Clones, what do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? Not bars, not sugary snacks, not energy drinks. No, we want beef. Pure and simple. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. Shriveled, dry, tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. It's tender, it's tasty, it's not tough. So what makes it so good? It's because Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. Old Trapper is packed with protein, and it comes in four amazing flavors to satisfy all your cravings. Quality smoked meat at its finest that goes with you wherever you go. Plus, it's in a clear view bag. That way you can see the quality that you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. Clones, if you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Ian Book is my guest. Ian, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Ian, thank you so much for doing it. So you beat Boston College 45-31. Let me start right there. That's a game, Ian, I think that could have easily been a trap because you were coming off that huge double overtime win over top-ranked Clemson. You know Boston College is always going to be fired up to play you. How would you describe the mindset and attitude then that the team had going into that game?
Yeah, I mean, first off, you know, Coach Kelly just did a great job of, you know, setting the message straight at the beginning of the week of, you know, obviously coming off of a very physical game, very emotional game against the number one team in the country. But then he just said, hey, it's a rivalry game. You know, we're playing for a trophy. This is a rivalry game that's had a lot of tradition for a long time. And they're a good team, really good team. So he did a great job of setting the message straight, and the team did an unbelievable job of responding to that. We went out there and got it done. Now we got a few more to go.
Notre Dame quarterback Ian Book is my guest. You know, there's a play in particular that I want to bring up. With just under 6 minutes to go in the second quarter, you had a second and goal from the 13 where your primary targets were covered and it looked like you might get sacked, but you backpedaled out of trouble. You found Ben Skowronek on the opposite side of the field. Brian Kelly said, quote, I'd like to say that we drew it up like that, but that's all Ian Book. So what do you remember about that play and how you executed it?
Yeah, I just remember going through my read, and then I remember – you know, feeling a little bit of pressure right in front of me, and just I do remember backpedaling out of there, and the receivers just did an unbelievable job last week of just getting open when I was extending the play and working back towards me. And Ben did a great job of getting separation, and I saw that he had some space, you know, to the sideline and could get into the end zone. So he did a great job of giving me a chance. But Yeah, it definitely wasn't drawn up like that, but we were happy to get in the end zone for sure.
We're talking Ian Book. So because of plays like that, you're now 28-3 in your career as a starter. In fact, you're on pace to have the most wins in school history, but it feels like in the last few weeks, you found an even higher level. You yourself said, I'm just elevating at the right time. So how have you been able to elevate your game the way you have recently?
Yeah, just there's a few things. I mean, I just try to, you know, be the same person every single day. But I've been working with Coach Reese for a long time now, and you know, just getting in the film room and just studying, you know, every little, you know, bits and pieces and details to the defense, to our offense, and you know what works well against certain coverages, and just taking it to the next level, and as well as chemistry. You know, we only had one spring practice, you know, but we've done an unbelievable job of just getting work in with each other every single day and working on chemistry. And I just really trust, you know, our tight ends, running backs, offensive line, and every guy on the perimeter that stepped up this year.
I think it's interesting what you just said, that you try to be the same person every single day. Why is that so critical, and what are you trying to guard against in that regard?
It's just part of being a quarterback, and especially at Notre Dame. You know, just there's a lot that goes on. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of privileges, but you just got to be level-headed, and that's part of the position. That's really just what it's, you know, it's quarterback's different than any other position, and that's what it takes. And that's kind of just what I tell myself every morning I get up, just be the same person, and things will work out the way that we want them to.
See, I was going to ask you about that, because being quarterback is one thing. I mean, that's a challenging enough gig as it is, but being the quarterback in Notre Dame is something totally different. That's one of the most high-profile positions, not just in college sports, but in all of sports, because of the pressure and the attention that comes along with it. It's not for everybody. You touched on it, but how would you describe what it's like to be the starting quarterback at Notre Dame and then everything that comes along with that gig?
Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's a dream come true for me. I've been wanting to play college football since I was in third grade, and just to land at Notre Dame is unbelievable. It's a dream come true. But, yeah, I mean, we got a target on your back when you're a quarterback. You got a target on your back that's a little bigger when you're the quarterback at Notre Dame, and that's just part of the position. But I just enjoy it. You gotta find a way to enjoy it. It's fun. It's a dream come true. But you do something well, everybody loves you, and it's amazing. If you do something bad, you're going to take all of the blame, and that's just part of it. And just had good people in my corner who've taught me to, you know, find a way to just listen to all that information and, you know, keep what's good and get rid of what's bad. So I've got a lot of good people in my corner.
Ian Book is joining us. I would imagine you've kind of experienced every one of those things. Like, as an example, Ian, you were not necessarily a household name in recruiting circles coming out of El Dorado Hills, California, but now you're on the verge of being the winningest quarterback in Notre Dame history. You're getting Heisman run. You're putting together a really special season. So maybe you're not wired for this per se, but is there any part of you that wants to say, okay, how do you all like me now?
Yes, there's definitely a part of that. I mean, and I was a three-star under-recruited quarterback. You know, a lot of people skipped, and that just kind of gave me a little chip on my shoulder. Kind of made me the person I am today. Obviously, I feel like I can play with anybody, and it's a good mentality to have. But, yeah, I know that's just part of it, and I know how I was recruited, and I know that, you know, why some teams skipped me and stuff like that, and being a three-star. But I just let that motivate me, and got a great group of teammates that, you know, are helping me have a lot of success on Saturday.
You know, you gave me a really good answer, but I'm just going to ask you this. Are you looking to prove people right, or are you looking to prove people wrong?
I'd rather prove people right, for sure. I've definitely thought about that and heard that before. You know, I got, like I said earlier, I got good people in my corner, and all those people who have trusted and believed in me, you know, from the beginning. I'd rather prove them right than anybody else. There's a lot of noise outside that just really doesn't matter.
Talking Ian Book and doing it for a few more moments. I know you're getting ready for North Carolina, but if you go back to that Clemson game for 1 minute, you led that team on a 91-yard drive against the top-ranked team in the country, and then you finish it off in double OT. When you go on a drive like that and you win a game like that against the number one team in the country, that's something that is going to be remembered forever. What did it feel like to be at the center of a moment like that and to finally break on through as a group, as a unit?
Oh, it was amazing. It's definitely a night that, you know, we will all remember forever. We definitely made history that night. And I remember a specific time after the game, I was with some of my teammates. We kind of just took a step back and we're like, we really did it. You know, it's just a game you're never going to forget. And no matter what, no matter how long you play football after this or whatever, it's a game that, you know, we worked really hard for. We had that game circled on our calendar for a long time, and we were able to get it done. But there's definitely more work to be had.
So you'll make it about the team. I know you will, but I mentioned the Heisman. Because of that game and the way you played this year, your name is coming up as a Heisman candidate. What is your reaction when you hear that?
Oh, it's really cool. It's awesome. And, again, I just know that if we take care of, you know, take care of business, you know, these next few weeks, and then hopefully in ACC championship and into the playoffs, you know, the rest of it will take care of itself. But, I mean, yeah, it's a true honor to be mentioned in any of those. It's definitely cool to see, and it's motivating for sure.
So, and finally, you mentioned Brian Kelly. Let me ask you about another member of the staff. Your offensive coordinator and QB coach, Tommy Rees, does know exactly what it's like to play quarterback at Notre Dame. How valuable, then, is it to have somebody like that working with you on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's truly the best. You know, I just feel like learning from somebody who's done it, you know, specifically Coach Rees has done literally everything that I've done. He's been in the same, you know, same pressures, same privileges that I've been at here at Notre Dame. It's just easier to learn from somebody like that. And it's been huge. He's been in my corner since he was my quarterback coach and now onto my offensive coordinator. He's just done such a good job. You know, he believes in me and trusts me, and I believe in him and trust him. And we're starting to get on the same page on a lot of things. And it's truly just amazing. I love him as a person and as a coach. And he's somebody that, you know, I can go to. It doesn't even have to just be about football. It can be about life. And he's in my corner, and I can't thank him enough.
So one quick follow. It's another one of those football lines, one of those lifelines. So pressure. Is pressure a burden or is pressure a privilege?
Pressure is a privilege. We've talked about that here at Notre Dame. You know, you might be nervous or might feel like you have pressure to go do something on Saturday. Think about those other people who would love to be in your spot playing in front of 80,000 people. You know, I mean, it's definitely a privilege. And feel fortunate and lucky to be out there playing football, that's for sure.
Did you went to high school, or you grew up in an area not far from Folsom. When I went to UC Santa Barbara when I was in college, I had a couple of guys on my dorm floor that were from Folsom. I went to Folsom once for the first time. You know, really nice place. What was it like growing up in the area that you did in Northern California? When you hit that campus in South Bend for the very first time, what was that like?
Oh, it's great. Growing up in NorCal has been amazing. And, yeah, I went to Oak Ridge High School, and we were rivals with Folsom, so I had a lot of good, you know, matches with them. It was awesome. But I remember my visit here at Notre Dame. I'll never forget. I came in the summer, and it's cliche, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, they feel at home, but I truly did feel really, really, really good about this place. You know, I've never been out to Indiana, and you know, I watched the movie Rudy, and that was about it. And then I took my visit out here and met Coach Kelly, and was just a beautiful summer day, and I just felt something, and I felt really good about it, and it's turned out, you know, to be an unbelievable experience.
He's the quarterback at Notre Dame. He's a two-time captain. I mentioned he's on pretty much every single watch list that matters for quarterbacks and player of the year. Notre Dame is 8-0. They're number two, and their next game is against North Carolina. Ian, glad we finally got you on the show. Great to talk to you. Great to meet you, and I hope we can do it again.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
The holiday season is upon us. It might not feel like it, because everything else going on in this cursed trip around the sun has made everything so jacked up. But it is here. Like it or not, it's here. And sooner or later, you're going to have to deal with it. You're going to have to work your way down that list, knock out your holiday gift shopping, and handle your business. In the event that you're short on ideas for what to buy that very special person in your life, have no fear. Because Russell Wilson and Ciara, his wife, have you covered. Did you know that the two of them would be the solution to all your problems? They've got you covered, literally. Because in what is probably the least surprising news of all time, Russ and Ciara have entered the couples fragrance space. Because, of course, and for just $90, you can give the gift of the brand new R&C cologne and perfume. Each scent is sold together as a package deal. That's the entire angle. His and hers sold as one. Men get the R cologne, women get the C perfume. Now, Russ's cologne is proudly described as patchouli, lime, lavender, and water lily. It sounds like perfume to me, as opposed to cologne. But hey, let Russ cook, right? Ciara's perfume is described as red berries and pink popcorn. The hell is pink popcorn? And does it smell like a movie theater floor? Did these two get their fragrances mixed up? Why does Russ smell like lavender and water lily and Ciara smells like popcorn? Anyway, the bottles themselves are trippy, just as trippy. The website describes RNC as, quote, irresistible fragrances crafted by Russell and Ciara, held within two entwined magnetic bottles, end quote. Magnetic bottles. The two bottles magnetically stick together as one. All right, then. That's how the website describes it. Van Smack describes it as the bottles being a couple of oversized chrome AirPods having sex. Because you got to see these things. Because it's not like you open up the box and you get separate bottles. No, you open up the box and you get two contorted bottles that are magnetically held together like robots, making sweet, sweet, passionate, dirty love. It's all pretty weird. It's all pretty weird, and it's all very Russ. Now, again, don't get this part twisted. I've got nothing against Russ. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. Russ, to me, is about the thing that I value most of all. Self-actualization. We should all be about that. We should all be about getting as much as we possibly can out of whatever it is we have. Seriously, how many of us are working or achieving anywhere near full capacity? None of us, including Russ. But I'm here to say Russ is closer to that noble goal than any of us. I could not respect Russ any more for it than I do. Like, in short, I have profound respect for Russ. This guy's a world-class talent, world-class work ethic, world-class focus, a serial philanthropist, genuinely good dude. He just does things in a very Russ manner at times. And at times, it can produce a certain kind of awkwardness and cringe. You know, like that time he announced his contract extension last year from his bed?
Hey, Seattle, we got a deal.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks. But I'm going to see y'all in the morning.
Good night.
Time for y'all to go to bed.
Finally, we can go to sleep.
See y'all in the morning.
Can't you just smell the lily and the pink popcorn? I know you can, Rit. Ambie? I don't know. That'd be like me. My next deal, whatever that is, whenever that is. Me under the sheets. Janet and I under the sheets. I'm like, hey, Jungle. Taking my act. To satellite. Yeah, we are, Van Smack. I don't know why my Janet impersonation is my Van Smack having sex impersonation. I just don't got that kind of range. Anyway, that was weird. That was strange. But not even as strange as that family pregnancy photos or photo shoot where the Wilsons and their kids all stripped down naked for a bear hug to visually announce that they were expecting. And that still wasn't even as strange as Russ self-glossing and declaring his new alter ego, Mr. Unlimited.
Hey guys, Russell here. Yes, the typical boring, yes, Russell, the robot Russell, the one you guys love to know. Real exciting. You know, I'm real exciting. But anyways, everybody has to have an alter ego, right? And I've been thinking about what my alter ego would be, and I think I have an alter ego. His name's Mr. Unlimited. Yeah, you gotta be unlimited. You know, you gotta have a thought process of being unlimited. So when people ask you, you know, what you're thinking about or what you want to do in life or where you want to go, you gotta be unlimited. Tell them, I'm unlimited.
See, the weird thing about that is, like, I see where he's going with that. And I agreed with it. He had me all the way through it until he took on that persona. He's right. He's like Mr. Robot. He knows how he's seen and viewed. That's pretty self-aware. He also has a, quote, unlimited mindset, which I respect. But then when he started acting it out as Mr. Unlimited, man, again, on brand. And so is slinging a couple's fragrance that comes in a couple of magnet bottles that spoon each other. Very much on brand. Because the fragrance, and here's why it's on brand. Not just because of the guy, but because of the space. Like, the fragrance space is a weird space. When was the last time you ever saw a normal cologne or perfume commercial? Especially cologne. Remember that introspective acid trip from Brad Pitt a few years back?
It's not a journey. Every journey ends, but we go on. The world turns and we turn with it. Plans disappear. Dreams take over. But wherever I go, there you are. My luck, my fate, my fortune. Chanel number 5. Inevitable.
Dude, I hope they paid you a lot of money for that. I hope they paid you all the money in the world for that, Bradford. It's as if it's impossible for a fragrance company to just say, hey, listen, dump some of this on your neck, dump some of this on your wrists. It smells good and you will get some. Dump some of this on your neck and you will get more than you ever thought possible. Sex. Lots of it. Lots of sex. Nope. They have to sufficiently trip you out for some inexplicable reason. But it must work, right? It must sell because they all keep working that angle.
There you are.
The weirder, the better, I guess. So maybe that RNC water lily and popcorn fragrance, man, maybe it will do well. Who knows? I know this. At least Russ and Ciara did not make a unisex fragrance for both men and women to wear like Chloe and Lamar Odom did back in 2011.
There's something sexy about a couple sharing a scent. Soft yet powerful, strong but sensual.
That perfect mix of masculine and feminine. There is a beauty of believing one cannot exist without the other.
That sometimes the bond between two souls is truly unbreakable.
Introducing a one-of-a-kind unisex fragrance, Unbreakable, by Chloe and Lamar, available at Perfumania.
You want to talk about cringy and awkward? Naked Chloe and naked Lamar selling a single bottle of fragrance, which they named Unbreakable, designed for both men and women. What's more weird? A man and woman sharing a single bottle of unisex cologne or calling a glass vessel unbreakable? When glass is like the most breakable material ever, it shatters into a billion pieces. Or the fact that Lamar and Chloe were the ones to call something unbreakable. I mean, they were pretty breakable. In fact, they split up after about 18 months of marriage. And no, I don't know if Lamar smelled like Unbreakable when he made that run to the Bunny Ranch in Vegas. Nor do I know if Chloe was wearing Unbreakable when Tristan Thompson stepped out on her on video at the club when she was pregnant with his kid. All I know is the fragrance industry is one of the stranger industries on the planet. And, well, I'm not surprised that Russ jumped right in. Hope you crush it with your water lily cologne, bro. And if Janet gives me any indication that she wants to smell like popcorn this holiday season, I'm down. I might just buy a bottle myself. Keep this in mind. And again, Russ is one of my favorite NFLers ever. I honestly could not respect him more than I do. I mean that sincerely. I also mean this sincerely. I'm not splashing his cologne on me. No offense. And that's not even a Russ thing or a cologne thing. Actually, it is a cologne thing. Like, I went through my Dracar phase when I was 14. Haven't gone back since. It's just a weird space. The fragrance space.
There you are.
There you are. Did you know that a fire department responds to a fire every 24 seconds? That's scary, but that's true. So we have teamed up with First Alert, the most trusted brand in fire safety, to help you prepare for the unexpected and to review some key safety tips. Smoke and carbon monoxide alarms can help provide an early warning in the event of a home emergency. Having enough First Alert smoke and carbon monoxide alarms is one of the very best things that you can do to protect your home and your family. What you want to do is install alarms on every single level and in every bedroom of your home. Once those alarms are installed, it's then important to maintain them by testing them with regularity. Remember, alarms do not last forever. They do have to be replaced at least every 10 years. And if you can't remember the last time you replaced yours, it's best to replace that unit completely. My recommendation? First Alert's combination smoke and carbon monoxide alarm with a 10-year sealed battery. The alarm provides 2-in-1 protection, and I don't have to worry about changing out that battery for a decade. Lastly, make sure you take time to discuss home safety with your family. Plan and practice an escape route, and remember to practice it at least twice a year so you are ready. And for more information on fire safety products, safety tips, and educational activities that you can do at home with your family, go to firstalert.com/fireprevention month. firstalert.com/fireprevention month. He is Matt Norlander. Matt, it is good to have you. What's up, my friend?
Jim, it's wonderful to be back on. It's bizarre because it's the middle of November and the draft is happening tonight and college basketball starts exactly 1 week from today. But it's a pleasure to be on, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you back, Matt. I was going to make the exact same point. The draft is tonight and you are part of the coverage for CBS Sports HQ, but I was going to say the same thing. It is so weird to have that draft in November, especially since we have not seen any of the college players on the floor in 8 months now. So overall, how would you describe this draft class?
I'm going to speak on behalf of what I've been told in recent weeks and days and months, and that is this is considered an underwhelming draft class, particularly within the framework of the past 10 to 15 years, looked as maybe arguably a bottom three draft class. At the top of it, it's considered weak. Maybe in the 15 to 25 range, whoever goes there, we might have a few gems. And there will be players that are taken tonight that when we look up 3, 5, 7 years from now, they've established pretty good careers for themselves. But the thing that keeps sticking out to me, and I know we'll get the guys at the top in a minute here, but I keep hearing from a couple of team sources that when they look at the mock drafts that are out there, there's really an expectation that guys that you might think are going to be taken in the late 30s, mid to late 40s, could easily pop into the 20s and then vice versa. So much unpredictability. And a lot of this is because of the free agency period that's bumped right up against the draft. The season is supposed to start next month, and these guys have not been able to be seen in a normal environment. So it's making teams have to rely on their best scouts even more than usual. And because of that, frankly, there's a lot of teams that think that they're going to have advantages in this draft because they trust their evaluators a lot more than some of the other teams that might not do their work quite as efficiently. On top of that, throw in what could be a record-setting night in terms of trades and team swapping spots, north of 30 picks changing hands tonight. It really makes for a draft that's impossible to forecast, and ultimately one that's going to be a little underwhelming, because when you look in the top 10, although you and I are familiar with these names, people that followed the draft, a lot of these guys, Jim, like, we didn't have a tournament. James Wiseman played 3 games last season. Obi Toppin was the National Player of the Year, but even he didn't have the grand stage to play in March Madness. And then guys like Tyrese Halliburton out of Iowa State, they weren't a good team last season. He got injured. So it's just going to be a bizarre experience having the draft. It's been the longest ramp up in the history of this event. And frankly, there's just not a lot of confidence that a lot of these players are going to be impact guys next season. Remember, there's not going to be a normal preseason. In fact, I had one source tell me that there's skepticism even like 15 of these guys are going to play significant minutes next season because there's not going to be a summer league. There's not going to be this 4 to 6 week period where they get acclimated with the teams and are working out as normal in the facility. So just keep that in mind when we talk tonight and see these guys go and see them picked. This really could be a less impactful draft 1 to 60 than we've ever seen because of the accelerated timeline to the 2021-22 season.
It is a really interesting response, and there's a lot to look to tonight based on that response in and of itself. Matt Norlander, my guest. So, Matt, go to the top of the draft, and you mentioned a number of guys that I did want to ask you about, but unlike last year when it was obvious for months that Zion Williamson was going to be the guy, there is a level of mystery surrounding this draft for a lot of reasons that you mentioned. There's been a lot of talk also about LaMelo Ball as the potential number one. What do you make of his game?
I think I might be the biggest seller on LaMelo Ball out there. He's got a really high ceiling. He's never proven to be a reliable shooter, consistent from deep. Obviously, 6'7", really good distributor, but have heard concerns about just, is this the kind of player that if you take number one, no matter what draft it is, if you're taking a player number one, if you were to go number one or number two, that is either a player that you expect to be a franchise-level guy or something close to it. And there's simply too much skepticism out there to say that that's going to be the case. I don't happen to think that when we look up 5-6 years from now and see whomever gets picked first, second, third, fourth, fifth, I don't think LaMelo Ball is going to be one of the five best players to come out of this draft. Yes, he's tantalizing because of his size, but I actually think that his body has some real concerns. He needs to grow into it a bit more. I think he's got a pretty weak base. Defensively, it's just not there at all. And that's kind of a criticism that sometimes is levied too consistently and harshly on guys coming out of college. And obviously, LaMelo didn't go to college, but when they enter the NBA draft, it's like, well, how good is he defensively? Sometimes I think that could be overstated. I think it is overstated with a guy like Obi Toppin, but LaMelo Ball, it's not even like defense is optional. It's like defense isn't even on the table, and that is something that concerns some teams. He is considered in that pool with James Wiseman and Anthony Edwards as the top tier, but for me personally, I'm just not in on him as a top five prospect in this draft, and I'm not alone. There are some teams out there that aren't even in that top three, top four conversation, but that I've been told wouldn't even consider taking him in that spot. If you take him and he hits, he's going to hit, and he could be really, really good. But fair or not, he is getting compared to his older brother. And Lonzo was taken second. He's been a good player, but he hasn't lived up to that pick. And I can say easily there are way more questions about LaMelo heading into this draft than there were about Lonzo when he came out of UCLA. So I am a seller, relatively speaking, but he is almost certainly going to go in the top three tonight.
Matt Norlander is my guest. All right, Matt, you mentioned Anthony Edwards a couple of times. What about him? He had that ridiculous second half against Michigan State out in Maui nearly a year ago. What do you remember about that performance, and what do you make of his game overall?
Well, the Maui, man, that's a year ago, Jim. That's just blowing my mind. Right? I'm pretty sure that was actually 6 years ago. You might want to fact check that. But anyway, that was a great performance, but Georgia was a non-factor. I've been told Minnesota is leaning Edwards if it does keep that top pick tonight and it wants to get rid of it. I don't know if it's going to be able to, but if Minnesota holds on to it, it seems like Edwards is going to be the play. I say that while also adding yet again, this is the hardest draft to forecast on the whole. Edwards is not a great playmaker. I think that if he hits big, he's going to be a guy that can give you 24 nights and is going to be a reliable top two scorer on your team. Really good athlete. I think a wonderful teammate and a smart player. But from a playmaking perspective, like, I don't even see him as a combo guard potential. He's just straight up lead guard, shoot first, and wants to get his. I think there are other players, like, for all my criticisms of LaMelo, like, he's obviously going to be a superior playmaker to Anthony Edwards. Guys like Killian Hayes, Tyrese Halliburton, much better playmakers than Anthony Edwards. So, again, relative to the guys that are around him, I'm just not as in. To me, Anthony Edwards is not the best prospect in this draft pool. And if you get him, you got to hope that he can be an immediate kind of scorer and give you dividends there. But it's no secret that Minnesota is not – it's not in an enviable position having the first pick in this particular draft when there's just no one out there that is seen as a surefire thing.
Matt Norlander is joining us, getting ready for the NBA draft. All right, now what about James Wiseman? He was in Memphis briefly. Then in December, he announced that he was going to leave to enter the draft after dealing with an eligibility case. At the time he announced that he was leaving, you wrote that you did not blame him for making that choice because, in part, quote, the adults failed him at just about every turn, end quote. Lay that out for me. What do you mean by that?
Well, this goes back to before Wiseman even got to Memphis and when Penny Hardaway basically paid for expenses for his family to move from one side of Tennessee to the other. That wound up being the reason why Wiseman, he only played 3 games for the Tigers. And, you know, Penny was not the coach at Memphis at the time when that happened. But, you know, the possibility of that happening was not this unthinkable thing, I think, for Hardaway. And he was doing a good deed, and he's done so much for that program, for that community. But between Wiseman's, you know, family, Penny himself, and then the fiasco that was a year ago when Wiseman was supposed to make his debut for Memphis and was in trying to get an injunction in a Memphis courtroom literally 80 minutes before tip-off of a game. I mean, it's the most Memphis basketball thing ever. It just became this huge melodramatic thing. He ultimately bailed out. He did get some criticism for that. Like, there were people in that program that straight up believed and still do believe that Wiseman quit on the team. And, there, you know, he had his reasons, but they might not have been good enough for that program. But regardless, that's what happened. And since then, you know, he's gone almost a year without playing competitive basketball. Weirdly, I wonder if that's going to not hurt him as much as it otherwise would have, because, again, so many people have not played competitive basketball since March. Anyone that was in college, they haven't been on the floor there. I do think he's got the highest ceiling of anyone in the draft, you know, but he is a center. So is he going to be able to prove, and will the teams ask him to step out and be able to shoot 18, 20, 22 feet from the rim? I don't know. Certainly plenty of interesting buzz about, you know, if Golden State were to hold on to the second pick and if he were to go there, how they'd make it work. He's got a lot of potential. I like him more than LaMelo. I like him more than Anthony Edwards. There are some limitations there. And again, just, you know, the lack of film, if you will, isn't interesting. And then one other thing that isn't obviously evident, and I wonder if it will or won't affect where he goes. You know, Wiseman had a weird thing about him before he got to Memphis, in that the grassroots team he played for, what people call the AAU team, he was often good, but he would have weird stretches where he would just not produce. He would disappear in games, and it was almost, you know, a classic case of a guy who's so ridiculously talented, you should be dominating basically every night out. That was not the case with Wiseman. So if he does not go one or two, I wonder if those kind of factors play in. But personally, I like him more. The only guy I like above Wiseman, I would take Obi Toppin number one in this draft. I think he is the safest pick. He doesn't have the highest ceiling. I think he has the highest floor. Took Dayton to levels it had never been before. Was the best player in college basketball that season. Tremendously athletic. I think the knocks on his defense are just way overstated. This dude shot 69%. From two-point range last season. That's obviously nice. He was 39% from three-point range. And again, he did it not just for Dayton in ways that had never been done before, but he was really, really good against really, really good teams. We mentioned Anthony Edwards and Maui last season. Toppin was absurd against Kansas, which was the best team in college basketball. To me, he's not going to go number one tonight. But I'm telling you, let's loop back in 5 years. I think Obi Toppin is going to be the best pro to come out of this draft.
Let's get to the beefs. Starting with social. Hi, Jim. And again, if you want to hit me with a beef on the phones, I'm here for that too. Phone line is 1-800-636-8686. Hi, Jim. You want to know what my beef is? My beef is with people complaining that Twitter still doesn't have an edit button. Proofread, you illiterate tools. Bella B in Calgary.
They're all buttholes out there. They really are.
Illiterate tool is not as offensive as butthole. You illiterate buttholes. I'm not going to tell you what to say, Bella. It's your beef. Dwayne Townsend tweets, my beef is my job wants me to work the day after Thanksgiving, and I'm not having it. Hell yeah, Dwayne. You get him, Dwayne. Dwayne at least spells his name properly. I feel you. Jimmy, my beef is with my girlfriend, who finds it necessary to repeat her grocery list item by item a half a dozen times before summoning the confidence to go to the store. I wasn't listening the first time. Just go to the store already and stop talking so much. I'm trying to listen to Rome. Brenton PC. Yeah, I'm not saying you should ever, ever, ever disrespect your significant other. I'm not even saying that that is disrespecting your significant other. That's funny, though. Her having to go down and run down the grocery list over and over and over again to make sure she's not forgetting anything. I like this one too. Jim, my beef is with takeout restaurants that are stingy with the sauce. Yes, I need 7 hot sauces with my breakfast burrito. No, 2 Chick-fil-A sauces is not nearly enough for this sandwich. I just gave you $9 for a bowl of rice. Please let me have an extra 6 cents worth of teriyaki sauce. Why do I have to work so hard to get enough of the sauce? I like my food to be well lubricated. Alex in SoCal. That's strong. You know, beefs are good, or at least they're consistent when I want to add my own beef to one of your beefs. I've got a similar beef. My beef is with local sushi joints that give you this much wasabi. Like, you just bought $50 worth of rolls, and they're giving you, like, one tiny millimeter of wasabi. How expensive can wasabi be? Man, load me up. My beef also, and I understand that there is a shortage. I do. Yeah. Normally when somebody says, I understand that there's a shortage, they don't give a damn about the shortage. Here's my other beef. If Janet and Logan and I are out to dinner and Janet says, may I please have a glass of water? And the waitress comes back with one glass. I got a beef with that. Why do all 3 of us have to ask for the water individually? can you just go to your sink and give us that tap water? Ed Yellow Robot tweets, Jimmy Jack Corn. I have a beef with the Jack Wagons who put 1,000 bumper stickers on their Prius. I don't want to coexist with you, moron. War Lady Clones.
War Lady Clones.
Abigail and SD. Abigail. I like that. She doesn't want to, quote, coexist. Abigail, SD, what, San Diego or South Dakota? Or San Dimas? Van Smack, my beef is with those one-hit wonders. Three-day weekend. I understand that following up the multiple platform Jace do is a daunting task, but look behind the glass today. There is enough material for a double hits album in writ alone. Get back in the studio. Thanks. Mark in Parts Unknown. Hey, listen. One smash is one more than most people ever have. There are a lot of bands that are one-hit wonders. Now, in fairness, Alvin does have his own song. That's good bleep right there. You know what's even better bleep? My song. Jim Rome! Listen, if somebody wants to carry the baton and write a song about Hawk and or Rit, do it. We're here for it. And you know we'll play it.
Finally.
Finally. And you'll get a big spin. You'll get a big spin with lots of ears and lots of eyes. So if you want to write a song about Rit and or Hawk, we're here for it. I'll play it. Jim, my beef? What is with these people that use floss picks to clean the spaces between their teeth and then just throw them on the sidewalk or in the grocery store parking lot? These jack wagons decide that their clean teeth equals somebody having to pick up their disgusting COVID-laden floss picks after they are done using them. Throw them in the garbage, losers.
Garbage!
Paul in the Denver suburbs. I mean, I was applauding that before I was halfway through it. He's so right. Like used syringes. I see that bull crap in the parking lot. That guy is so right. Good job, Paul. I'd walk off on that one. Nobody's doing better than that. You do see those things all over the place. War Lady Clones. Hey, Susie, what up?
War Lady Clones.
Susie from Wisco. Hey, Jim. I got beef. I got beef on that. Signed, John in New York.
The only chance Buffalo has, honestly, Jim, of winning any type of championship is if Rick in Buffalo rips a, if he rips the smack off. So,
War Lady Clones. No.
War Lady Clones.
See you, Susie. Garrett in Utah, quote, our beef is with masks too small for our fat? Wide faces. Signed, Johnny in Texas. His fat, wide face.
Hey, John.
One size does not fit all. Am I right, John?
Hey, John.
1-800-636-8686. All right, let's go to the phones. The beef segment also includes the calls. Let's go to Nick in Chicago. Nick, what's your beef?
Hi, Jim. My beef is with Dr. Dave in Chicago. I just sustained a major injury on the field, and all he offered was an ibuprofen. I mean, at least give me a splint or something, for real. I just snapped my hog in half, and all he's got is holistic remedies.
That's not a good call.
Hey, Alvin, no. Was it not enough that the guy pretended to be Rex to get him run?
Not a very good call.
And what? Was him referencing Nick's hog not enough to get him run? That was like Rex pretending to be Nick Foles snapping his, quote, hog. Did you need to let that breathe? 1-1000. All right. This is the beef segment. And as always, the tweets are way better than the calls. Let's try somebody else. Tom in Tampa Bay. That already sounds like a bad idea. Tom in Tampa Bay. I'll play along. Tom in Tampa Bay, what is your beef?
Hey, Tom. I'm Jim. It's Tom Brady. And how you doing, buddy? Hey, listen, I got a fantasy issue. Should I play myself or Patrick Mahomes this week? Come on.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Come on.
So, just so I have that straight, that was the fake Silk doing the fake Tom Brady. After fake Rex did the fake Nick Foles. This is getting really confusing. Really confusing. 1-800-636-8686. Let's go to Kenny in Albany. Kenny, what's your beef?
My beef is with that babysitter, Jeremy, in Green Bay. Keep my name out your mouth and your tweets. Glass houses, Jeremy. You like the 8th best call on your zip code, and I'll keep it PG in case you're babysitting. But, pimp, no more script, no more promises, just beef. And, Jeremy, I'm coming for you. Late. Thanks for the Vaughn.
I mean, at least he tried to give me a straight beef, right? He didn't pretend to be somebody he's not.
Keep my name out your mouth.
1-800-636-8686. It's the beef segment. We're running out of time. If you're watching on CBS Sports Network, you know it's the beef segment because, well, look to my left. There's a gigantic plastic tower of beef. Let's go to Austin. Oscar, what's your beef?
My beef is with UFC fighters and how they walk up to the octagon fully dressed. Boxers walk up to the ring, simply have their handlers yank off their sequin robe, and that's it. They're ready to rumble and ready to go. But UFC fighters, on the other hand, we viewers got to sit there and wait while they shed their Beats by Dre that they have on their melons and then remove their affliction hoodies and pull off the tap-off tee and sweatpants, which invariably get stuck to their New Balance kicks. Hey, Dana White. Talk to your roosters, man. Tell them to step up to the octagon ready to work and quit wasting my time. Afuera.
All right. It's not too bad. I don't agree with it, but not too bad. At least it's a beef. I don't know, Oscar. You check out our guy Deontay Wilder. He didn't show up in only a robe. Not only did he not show up in only a robe, he showed up in a 40-pound costume and then blamed it for his performance. So that's not really fair or accurate. Also, if you're a UFC-er and when you consider what those guys are about to do, they can walk up any way they want, man. They're taking their lives into their own hands every single time. I don't have an issue with that. It's a show. It's a show, and part of the show is trying to get in your opponent's head and brand yourself and promote yourself and market yourself and push pay-per-views. What is your beef? I've got time for one or two more if they're good enough. Let's try Houston. Why not? Jerome. Hey, Jerome, what's your beef?
Hey, Vance Mack. Thanks for the Vaughn. I'll tell you, I got three quick beefs. Number one, my beef is with these tire repair shops that when I picked up one nail, they figure out there's 10 things that are wrong with the tire that I need to replace the tire. Well, on these Michelin awesome tires, it's like $400. No. You fix it and get me back on the road. And my other beef, James Harden, please, please, please meet Rome's dream and all of our dream and go over there with Harden. I mean, with Durant and Kyrie. I can't wait to see that. That's going to be the most awesome thing I've ever seen in my life. Get him out of here. He has no dog. And when I say dog, he has no fight in him. When it really counts, he just ain't got it. And that's all I got. I had one more beef, but I forgot because I'm really baking strong. I'm out.
Well, thank you for calling, Jerome. He called in with three beefs. He got through two of them, but could not recall the third because I'm, quote, really baking strong. He is Dennis Dodd. Dennis, what's going on?
Jim, I miss Crystal Cove so much during these uncertain times, but thanks for having me on. How are you?
I'm doing great, Dennis. I would say the same thing, and I don't live that far from there, and I still can't get there, so I know exactly what you're talking about. So let me jump right in, Dennis. One thought going into the season was that it was going to be really difficult for college football programs to fire their head coaches because of the buyouts and what that would mean when there is reduced revenue due to COVID, yet South Carolina fires Will Muschamp over the weekend despite a massive buyout. What do you make of that decision, and what does that say about how badly they want to get away from him?
Yeah, I mean, it just broke the seal on everybody, you know, assuming that, oh, they're going to be more conservative this year. It's going to be a mulligan year, which I suggested in the summer that, you know, something like the virus might be working the favor of a guy like Clay Helton at USC or Tom Herman. It wasn't a complete evaluation of what they could do, but, you know, the song remains the same, Jim. They fired Will Muschamp slightly before, a month before early signing period. That tells you all you need to know. It's always about recruiting. It's always about getting ahead to the next guy. And, you know, $15 million buyout be damned. The fact that it's going to cost South Carolina upwards of $30 million plus to change staffs when it's all said and done, be damned. It's just business as usual.
It's an incredible number, really. Dennis Dodd, even when you know what it is and you know what the business is, $30 million. So when you talk about it, it's always about the next guy, Dennis. What about that next guy? For instance, if you had to say right now, is Hugh Freeze the next guy there? Will they be able to look past everything that went down at Ole Miss and hire him?
Yeah, I think they would. I don't think it would be a question of South Carolina. I mean, if you're willing to fire Will Muschamp and eat all that money, you know, you've been given some sort of assurance, or you know, or you're fine with Hugh Freeze coming. So I don't think that's a problem. I think he's wrestling with it. I think it's really enticing. He's very interested, but he also knows that if he stays another year at Liberty, you know, there could be a better job open. And I think he's gone through the car wash enough. You know, you're referring to the NCAA issues at Penn State and some moral Ole Miss and some moral failings at Ole Miss. I think he's gone through the car wash enough to come out on the other end a different perception. He's really worried about what Greg Sankey will do, because you kind of have to get the blessing of the commissioner after NCAA sanctions to coach in that league. I don't think personally Sankey would stand in the way this time, but I know that Hugh Freeze is worried about it. So he's number one in the clubhouse. The clubhouse isn't very big. But after that, it may be a guy like Billy Napier at Louisiana.
We're talking to you, Dennis Dodd. All right, Dennis, you've got a piece up on CBSSports.com right now that's got the following headline, quote, "Hope feels lost at Michigan, and 2020 looks to be the end of the road for Jim Harbaugh," end quote. Michigan's 1-3. They're coming off that humiliating loss at home to Wisconsin, where they trailed 28-0 at halftime. How bad was that loss, and how terrible has this season been for Harbaugh and Michigan?
Well, that was a new level of low against Michigan. That wasn't losing to your rival, Ohio State. That was getting blown out at home and not showing up. Forget that there's not fans in the stands. There's not fans in the stands anywhere. That's not even an excuse. Michigan should be better than Wisconsin, or at least not be down 28-0 at halftime, which, by the way, is the largest halftime deficit for Michigan in the history of the Big House that goes back to 1927, 93 years. So then you got to question the buy-in, the want-to. And I asked Jim Harbaugh that question Monday on his Zoom call, and, you know, he didn't answer it directly. He took off his glasses and looked into the camera and said, you know, I'm focused, I'm ready, you know, let's just go. But that was a new level of low. And it just seems like for all the world now, after 1-3 start, we're starts in 67, that there is inevitably going to be a change at Michigan. And then it just becomes a question of how that happens. I don't think Jim Harbaugh will allow himself to be fired by his alma mater. He's the ultimate Michigan man. I think it'll take the form of some sort of mutual agreement where he goes to the NFL or something like that, or sits out a year. But I don't think it'll be this big, ugly firing like a Will Muschamp in the middle of the season. I just can't see that happening.
Dennis Dodd's my guest. All right, so Dennis, this guy was the savior. He is the ultimate Michigan man. He played quarterback there. He played quarterback in the NFL. He can't develop quarterbacks. There is no buy-in from his players. They seem like they really don't care that much at all. How could this have gone so, so wrong for him? What happened to this guy and that program?
Whoops, you dropped. Go ahead.
I was saying, Dennis, what exactly happened to Harbaugh? Because he was the savior. He was the Michigan man. He was the guy who played quarterback there. He was the guy that had all the answers, the big contract, all the money. I mean, this was the guy to turn this thing around, and it couldn't have gone any worse. Exactly what happened? How did he fail so badly there?
Well, he as a coach, he has a shelf life. If you look at his previous jobs, he's kind of a four-year guy. So you throw that in with the fact that it's now year six at Michigan. Yes, he didn't develop quarterbacks, and he came along at a time, Jim, that Ohio State was taking off. It may be a case of how schools view each other. I looked it up. Michigan, since 1905, Michigan has had one 12-win season. That was the 97 season when they won the national championship. In 2012, Ohio State has had seven seasons of at least 12 wins. So it's not even a comparison right now in terms of program, team speed, recruiting, everything. But he came along at that time, and he was more widely successful than Brady Hoke or Rich Rodriguez, but it wasn't good enough because everything is viewed through the lens there of Ohio State. And Ohio State is out in the stratosphere. Maybe everybody in college football, certainly Michigan.
Thing is, I mean, I agree with you, but as we know, it's not just Ohio State, right? It's Michigan State. Indiana got them. Wisconsin beat them down. So it is certainly Ohio State, but there are other things. Dennis, Ed Orgeron is also on your hot seat rankings. As you write, nobody was expecting LSU to go 15-0 once again, but nobody expected them to go 2-3 and suffer some really ugly losses. And that was before USA Today had that report regarding allegations of ignored sexual abuse by players. Could you see a scenario in which Orgeron is fired?
Yeah, I think it'd be really hard to fire him. They're still the draft, still drafting off that 15-0 season. But things haven't gone well. As I pointed out, I think everybody expected them to decline a little bit this season. But before the season, Alabama-LSU was still one of the biggest games on the SEC calendar. And now it's like, well, you know, it's an afterthought. Will it get played or not? You know, does it need to get played? You know, we don't know. In that, you know, they've had injuries at quarterback. They just haven't been good defensively. I thought most of the blowback would be on Bo Pelini, the defensive coordinator, but it's actually been on Orgeron from the fans I've talked to. And they've even, I shouldn't say this, but there was one who even used the word Gene Chizik. And Gene Chizik was a guy who won a national championship and then subsequently went 0-8 in the SEC and got fired. I don't think we're talking about that here. But I think it's more of an indication of how demanding the fans and LSU and the SEC are. I said before the season, this will be a downturn, and I think from now on, as long as Orgeron is there, they'll be a perennial top 10 team. I thought they'd gotten to that place. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they just caught lightning in a bottle with Joe Burrow and those guys.
We're talking to Dennis Dodd for a few more moments. And Dennis, right now there is a top four where Notre Dame and Clemson have played eight games. Alabama has played six. Ohio State's played just three. Is there a point where teams from other conferences start to make noise that Ohio State or another Big Ten team is going to play significantly fewer games than teams in other conferences?
I did that story in the summer, Jim, where I asked the people that mattered, is there going to be a conversation about a minimum qualification number of games played for the playoffs? And Bob Bowlesby from the Big 12 said that has to be a conversation, but not now. Well, here we are in the season, and nobody's even touched that question to their detriment, because you're looking at a situation, I'll just give you an example, where you could have a Wisconsin that, let's say they upset Ohio State, and this is just an example, but they will have played seven games. They'll be 7-0. They could be fighting a 10-1, a 9-1 Texas A&M second place in the SEC West for a playoff spot, or an 11-0 conference champion Cincinnati, who's the best non-power five team out there by far this year. How do you do that? How do you fairly do that? So they're going to get in that room. I think they've gone this far. It's just going to be the old eye test, Jim. They're going to try to rationalize it the way they usually do.
All right. So I was going to say, Dennis, if it is the old eye test and they do what they've normally done, I mean, are we talking about, is it accurate to say that the four playoff teams should be Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, and now Notre Dame because they beat Clemson?
Yeah, I think the first three for sure. There's going to be a rematch with, if things hold, with Notre Dame and Clemson. And if Notre Dame wins out, they'll be the fourth. And if Clemson wins, they'll be in there, but there'll be a spot open. And so does Notre Dame, who I think is playoff worthy. I think even with a close loss or some kind of loss to Clemson, because they've already beaten them, they've proven they can beat the number one team in the country, would be a strong candidate for that fourth spot above, again, a 9-1 Texas A&M who beat Florida and would be in second place in the SEC West. And at that point, I don't think an unbeaten Cincinnati would be a discussion point. But this is the closest any of those group of five teams have ever gotten to being a discussion point in the room. So, I think Notre Dame in that scenario, win or lose, would have a pretty good shot at that fourth spot.
He is a national college football writer for CBSSports.com, friend of the program, and a Javier's aficionado. He is Dennis Dodd. Good job, Dennis. Great to have you back. Thanks for the time, as always.
All right, shrimp enchiladas forever. Thanks, Jim.
Good night now!